I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, everyone, and you're very welcome to this week's Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh, and I'm joined by Andy Doyle and Stephen Robb for a very special edition of this week's show. Land is wet and grain markets are relatively quiet, so we're concentrating on tillage pages this week, and they're no ordinary pages. Most listeners will know by now that tillage legend Andy Doyle is retiring from his job as tillage editor. And Andy, you've been looking back at your 40 years in the industry in this week's paper. And we're going to chat through some of those pages now, Andy. And so over the next 2 weeks, there's two double page spreads. And you're looking back on some of the highs and lows and evolutions from the industry gone by. You might give listeners a bit of a taste of what's to come.
Yeah, Siobhan, it was a very big job to kind of go back and remember. I've had 30 odd years in the journal and another 10 before that involved in research and education in UCD. And when I came into the industry, and you know, arguably I could have gone to any sector at the time, but it was a phone call from Eamon Gallagher after finishing my basic degree that took me into cereal research. And you know, I'm very glad because I've lived a very rewarding life in there and met a lot of people over the years. But that was a very exciting time to be there. We had just joined the EEC. Europe was short of cereals. There was a big drive on to increase production, but prices and incomes were really good from cereals, as they were from most other sectors during that price adjustment period. So, you know, there was a hunger for information, there was a hunger for technology, there was a hunger for output. And in that sense, I was in the middle of all of that at a very important time in history.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you say that, like, because I suppose at the minute we're at a time where tillage and cereals are, you know, the focus is back on them again and their importance. And we're also at a time where there's a shortage of people in our industry. So you were in education for those first 10 years, Andy, and like you saw a lot of people go through the sector and, you know, continue on into the sector and to where it is today.
Yes, indeed, Siobhan. And, you know, I suppose not that many of the people who started around that time are still anywhere in the industry. Some, unfortunately, are no longer with us. Most others either changed sectors or jobs or are retired ahead of me. But yeah, it was much easier to get people interested in a sector that was vibrant, that was being driven by productivity. You know, it's a very different scenario to try and encourage people into a sector that's been dominated by policy as distinct from dominated by productivity. And that's where we were then. We could just drive on productivity. Every little bit of new technology that could be proven could be recommended. And in fairness to farmers in the tillage sector, they were extremely good at taking on technology, taking technology on board and using it at farm level. I think, in fairness, in the knowledge that virtually all the technologies they were being given at the time had been researched, had been proven in Ireland, and therefore it was a relatively safe bet down the line for people like me to recommend them. And it was always a great dilemma in the job that I was in. You know, you have new technologies being coming. The story is good, but they're not proven. What do you do with them? You know, it has always been an issue for me that if I recommend somebody to spend a pound or a euro, I would want them to be getting back more than a pound or a euro. And that's always been a challenge. And it's a bigger challenge nowadays because we get a lot of the more academic research and it's all very good, but we'd get less of the really practical evaluation of the tools and products that are available in the market, with the exception of fungicides and to a lesser extent herbicides.
I suppose, Andy, just to put that in context, can you put figures on that? You know, when you started out in the tillage game, you know, what would a typical winter wheat crop yield compared to where we are now, and when did you really start to see the increases in yields?
There wasn't that much. There certainly was some winter wheat ahead of the ending of the 70s. But when we got into the 80s, kind of typical crops would be doing 3.4, 3.6. 3.5 would have been a good average. Then came 1983. I remember 83 well. A remarkably good summer that followed a relatively good growing season. And it gave a relatively average harvest, but extraordinarily high prices in an Irish context. The prices were only high in Ireland, really, but they were very high in comparison to what we were used to. Like, I think it's important to put it in perspective that if I can talk in just pounds for a minute, but the comparison is pounds, somewhere in the 70s, something like feed barley would have been 55, 60 pounds a ton. Before we got to the mid 80s, that was 120 pounds a ton. And an intervention kind of propping that up there. So, you know, the potential for income was massive, but the availability of the technologies then came on top of that yield potential for winter wheat. And in 1984, nobody ever admitted to growing a crop that was less than 4 tons per acre. I'm sure they did, but nobody would admit it. That's a failing of farming in terms of where the fruit gets left to one side in certain situations. But it was a remarkably good year where inputs were almost displaced by nature. As a researcher at the time, some of the things that were normally giving us yield benefits did not give yield benefits in 1984, because nature gave us everything that the crop wanted. So the man that had a good field and the man that had a bad field, they almost both got the same yield because nature intervened everywhere. And the point that I would always make is the one of the most important elements of nature that's capable of influencing I'm going to say the poor field, the field that doesn't normally give as much, is the whole soil health scenario. So in a year where nature gave it all, then that field could give yields that people weren't used to seeing. And that's why I've always had such an such a desire in recent years to try and get people to think of soil health, because it is the single most important factor. If nature is going to give it to you for free, then that's the best way to be farming. And in the meantime, we've ended up with lots of new inputs going into crops because they've had to go in because nature wasn't giving us as much as it used to. So we had more trace element difficulties. We had more problems with tightening soils, less water percolation, the type of things that give rise to the patchy crops that we're seeing about the place this year. But the cost of production then would equally, of course, have gone the same road, Stephen. You know, I can't remember what the cost of production was precisely, but I'm going to guess in the order of 260, 300 pounds an acre at the time. You know, that's now gone, well, in excess of 800 euro and probably knocking on the door of 1,000 euro all in for winter wheat today. And some of that is the fact that inflation has come along with costs, but a bigger part of it is all of the additional costs that are now being used as part of a system to grow the crops that we grow today.
Well, I suppose, Andy, I'm just looking at the pages here in front of me, and you've given a damn good synopsis of the various kind of themes and changes within those themes over your working career. And you mentioned one of them earlier, and that was the inputs which were required. And maybe it might be worth just having a chat on how you've seen the plant protection sector change over the years where you've been working.
Yeah, there's certainly been dramatic change in that sector. I mean, look, there was a plant protection business in existence when I came into the industry in the late 70s. The tools were very modest in their capability compared to what we have today or what we had in the interim. But it was really when we began to see the triazoles appearing in the early 80s. Late 70s, early 80s, when the Baileyton range came into being, that we really had a tool that was well fit to drive on yield potential. Like, I think at that stage, people were very conscious of the fact that we had a naturally higher yield potential in our land because it was fresher and had higher output potential relative to the genetics of the day. But we had relatively poor tools to protect that potential, having helped nature to give it to us. And I can absolutely remember in the early 80s going out trying to do fungicide trials with something like Baileyton. And at that stage it was still quite effective on mildew, but you would literally have to have curtains on the sprayer to prevent any little bit of drift from moving left or right into a neighbouring plot, because it was so sensitive, or the natural fungal population was so sensitive to the fungicide that it would actually clean it up even if it was never sprayed, just with the drift that was coming in. I'll quickly add, that situation didn't last that long. You know, we weren't probably 3 or 4 years into using the better fungicides when diseases like mildew quickly broke down against the particular fungicides, or the fungicides broke down against the fungus. And, you know, you stand back from that then, and that was the story of how nature, the story of the battle between nature and the chemicals that we were using then over the next 30, 40 years. Where we've had quite a number of instances of resistance. But the big difference back then, going back into the 80s and into the 90s, was the fact that we had a significant pipeline of new actives that kept coming on board. So just about the time when a product may be weakening or giving way completely, another one was nearly always arriving. And as they arrived, we got another resurgence of life in fungicides. And it was really only when the Straubs came in the very late 90s that we kind of jumped up a gear in terms of the response that we got once again from the use of fungicides in crop production. And it wasn't, that came not just because of their ability to control diseases, and God knows that was a very strong ability when it was there, but those particular chemicals also had a significant impact on other aspects of plant physiology and growth. And when you combine all of those things, they were in a sense giving back some of the characteristics that nature would have given us 20 years earlier on fresher ground. and we got this next yield jump. But of course, strobs then tended to be used not according to recommendation, used more times than it was sensible. And in 2001, we had the unfortunate scenario of witnessing a significant breakdown of the strobs, specifically to Septoria thuiticae. That, you know, signaled in some respects the beginning of the end. Yes, we had we were lucky enough to get SDHIs coming on stream, and we have new products coming on stream again. But between the slowing of the pipeline and the fear of resistance, we have to now face up to the fact that we cannot depend on fungicides alone to do the job of plant protection that's going to be needed in the marketplace going forward.
Yeah. And Andy, like, you've seen such dramatic improvements in yields, like, but you know, whether it be the use of fungicides or the evolved genetics, like, I mean, the improvement in your 40 years has been massive. Do you think, you know, we're kind of at a plateau now that it's going to be more difficult to hit those higher yields or to take another big jump in yields?
No, Siobhan, I don't think we're at a plateau. Like, I'll probably say we were at a plateau on wheat yields in Ireland for quite a long time, up to almost the end of the noughties. And we were at a plateau because our land was continuously worn, and in the main it was being monocropped. And at the end of the day, monocropping is very good for convenience, but it is not conducive to big yields. And as we stood back, and I can remember giving a talk one night, probably 50 and plus years ago in your own county in Laois, and just put up a graph for the very first time, which gave actual average national yields for winter wheat and spring barley relative to where I felt the genetics had taken the varieties that we were now growing. And the gap was bigger and bigger. The yield plateau was very obvious in winter wheat, but the gap was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And my comment on the night was, we can't afford to let this keep happening. You know, we made a name for ourselves globally as being the highest yield producers in winter wheat, and arguably also in barley. We didn't get the official status in barley. We were generally beaten by Belgium, but Belgium was kind of predominantly a winter barley producing country with some spring barley, and we were the other way around. But we were a very close second, despite the fact that the spring crop was our dominant crop. So, you know, we were a potentially high yielding nation. So look at nowadays, and I know recently I wrote that article about, is it time to be thinking of 15 ton or 11 ton on spring barley and 13 ton on winter barley? And, you know, I don't say things like that lightly, because I think as we look towards the things that are now helping our soils, be it the catch crops, the straw incorporation, trying to avoid compaction, doing things to try and address problems in fields, to try and store more carbon, to try and capture more carbon, all of those things will bring back a level of plant health that will gradually edge up yields as we go forward. And if we can add to that an element of a circular economy, where the nutrients we have been exporting now for 50 years can start coming back in, the organic nutrients can start coming back in to form a tillage, a circular economy within the tillage sector, I think we can again see another jump. Like, I'm looking at what the individual farmers have achieved in the YEN project, which is an ADAS-driven project. And, like, you know, they've all been able to produce field averages of 6.2, 6.3, 6.4. And we know that the world average yield at the moment, I guess, 6.79. So these are the genetics that are there today, and they're the things that people need to be targeting going forward. It amazes me, for the past decade and a half, that we still see all the discussion groups of the country talking about this fungicide versus that one, this option versus the other one. And, you know, any option of good fungicide selection is probably not a euro, or at most 2 euro an acre in terms of its cost, probably no difference in terms of yield. But the thing that's costing us a ton to 2 ton an acre of missing yield, we're not even talking about yet. And that to me has been a major disappointment, I suppose, of my tenure, that I didn't manage to crack that way of thinking.
I was just going to say, like, policy, and we give out about policy a lot, but policy has helped with some of that, hasn't it? Whether it be the tree crop rule or cover crops or straw incorporation, it's forced farmers in some ways to move to get that extra yield.
Yes, Siobhan, and I remember, as all of these policies evolved at the time, commenting to myself that this is a fundamentally good policy. And, you know, the tree crop rule, pushing people away from monoculture, was a good rule. The problem with it was not that you had to have three crops, but we're trying to comply with the percentages, and then trying to do that across shared farmed arrangements and that type of scenario, which made management very difficult. But the fundamentals behind having to have rotation are fundamentally good. You know, we went for many years calling oats a break crop. And oats, you know, I suppose in terms of our modern definition of a break crop, it is. You won't get take-all in wheat following oats. But that's not the definition, a proper definition of a break crop, as in the suppression of take-all. It's a lot more than that. It's how root systems interact to make nutrients more available. You know, when I was a chap growing up, I can remember folks around home in Wexford talking about growing beans, and it was beans as distinct from sugar beet. And in growing the beans, they associated with beans as a crop that had a deep taproot to access phosphate and potash deep in the profile, suck it in through the deeper root, get it into the circulation system within the plant. And when it was finished with the surplus at the end of the season, it would spew it out closer to the top of the ground. And that nutrient supply was there then to help feed the following crop, whatever that would be. And that was at a time when we were definitely at the very early stages even of fertilizer use, because fertilizer use technology is, well, it's not quite within my lifetime, but it's not far from it. So, you know, so many of the technologies that are there today are new. And, you know, that's just the world around nutrients. But there's also the big benefits, for example, of putting in different root systems, getting crops in there, the tap rooted crops, the sugar beet, etc., to open up the ground, to let the roots of the next crop penetrate so that they too could make use of nutrients that were deeper in the ground. But more importantly, they would have the insurance of having access to water in that kind of a year. So there's been so much. And then there's the whole, an area that we know nothing about, is the influence of the bacteria that grow around the roots of one crop and the potential benefit or negative effect that it could have on another crop. And, you know, the way that the organisms in the ground, they can be multiplied by a crop to, for example, suppress something like take-all, that natural take-all defense mechanism that's there in a rotational scenario is done by something promoting certain types of organisms in the ground and suppressing others. And, you know, in terms of our knowledge of that area, you know, are we still scratching at the surface at best?
Yeah. And I think it's worth looking back maybe at, and I know it's not necessarily in your articles, but I mean, looking at maybe some of the mistakes of the past 30 or 40 years, you know, maybe some of the factors that led up to, you know, the collapse of Straub's in 2001, was it our fault, more or less, like, you know, was it over-reliance, or maybe even in the plant breeding game, you know, possibly focusing too much on one characteristic and inadvertently breeding weaknesses in a variety that, you know, still haunt us today. You know, what would you see as kind of the bigger mistakes in the tillage game over the past 30 or 40 years?
Perky, Stephen, that's a very big question. It certainly is answerable, but probably in small bits. You know, you made reference to the fact that plant breeders went in a certain direction that gave us varieties that were more susceptible to our major diseases. That probably is true. Sorry, not probably, that is true. But I can remember writing it more than a decade ago. The plant breeders have in history often come up with varieties that were much better on disease, much more robust on disease, not just better, but durably better. But there was never a market for them. And the reason there wasn't a market for them was because they showed 1 or 2%. below the best yielding varieties of the day. And at the end of the day, people could afford, firstly, they had access to the technologies that could fill the gap of the weakness. And B, they could afford them. The economics were still right at the time. So the plant breeders, in a sense, they followed the money. They followed the seed that was going to sell. So we can't blame them for that. I do hope today that they're looking at the other options, because we're less able or less well able to fill the gaps in the weaknesses than we were, say, 20, 25 years ago. Looking at other things, you know, we forgot an awful lot of good husbandry. But Stephen, I also think it's important to say, you used the word mistakes that farmers made. I'm reluctant to call them mistakes, but things that we did that subsequently proved to not be the right thing. I'm saying it's different to a mistake, because at the end of the day, all of agriculture globally followed the route of convenience. So if there was a bag or a bottle cure for a problem, that's what you used, for example, rather than roguing wild oats. So I do make reference to the fact that in those very early years, only some fields had wild oats, and virtually none had things like sterile brome or any of the other major grass weeds. Yes, they had annual metagrass. Yes, we had rough stalk metagrass, which is now almost unseen. So we had different problems. But people opted to allow those problems to get big. In the case of annual metagrass, probably there was little you could do. But in the case of the more persistent and deadly ones, like wild oats, the fact that we stopped roguing was a major problem, because we allowed one plant to turn into 20 in a square meter, and we allowed 20 to be dragged all over the field to give us a contaminated field. And 100 years later, we'll still be dealing with that problem. So, you know, we were blinded to the pressures that nature were throwing against us for as long as we had cures. And, you know, there are people who still today have always rogued wild oats. They have a very, very small problem. They don't have to spray. And as a consequence, they have, I suppose, a bit more money in their pocket. But they also have a scenario where if resistance happens, they don't have a problem that can't be dealt with.
Yeah.
Yes.
We might stay on mistakes for a minute, Andy, and on the pages in this week's edition of the paper, you're talking about sugar beet, and you have sugar RIP on the heading. Was that a major mistake of the tillage industry, the loss of the sugar beet industry?
Yes, I think it was, Siobhan, and I say that in a very considered way, because I lived through all of that at kind of both ends. In the 80s and going into the 90s, the common practice on farms would be to get the sugar beet. It would pay for virtually all the fertilizer on the farm, and probably still leave some money. The sugar beet regime itself, by virtue of how it was operated by the sugar company and then Irish Sugar, it ensured that the land on which sugar beet was grown was always up to a fertility level, be that pH, be that P's and K's, etc. And it gave an asset to the industry that it never realized it had until such time as it was gone. The sugar beet, by its nature as well, added massively to the ground. Like for most people who had sugar beet, the return of the beet tops or the grazing of the beet tops returned a significant amount of organic matter to the ground, albeit on a rotational basis when the straw was being sold. That was contributing far more than anybody realized until you went 15 years after the ending of sugar beet. And you began to see that, you know, leading up to that 15th year afterwards, that you were just getting, soils were getting tighter and all the rest that went with it. And the performance was going. It was interesting to look at the efforts to revive the sugar beet and the way the different elements of a new policy were being thought out relative to the old policy. And the problem at the time was that the European Union agreed a policy with developing countries called the EBA, Everything But Arms. And that basically gave them the option to send cane-related sugar, predominantly cane-based sugar, into the European Union, and the European Union was guaranteeing to take it and to get it in without any duties or any other tariffs, etc. So basically, we then had that supply element coming into a self-contained industry, and that meant that the people inside had to produce less, or the market had to grow, one or the other. So all the preparations were made for the market to produce less. Those signals were being sent around the place. Ireland was staring a reduction in its sugar quota in the face. And in fairness, I have to say in passing that the arrangements for the management of the quota and the pricing regime organised between what was then the BVA / IFA and the Irish Sugar / the Sugar Company, it was a really good regime, because I always marvelled at the difference in price levels that existed between here and our nearest neighbour. And it was all because the industry was controlled internally here by the two major parties involved, the processors and the producers. And in fairness to them, they did a great job on it. But when the decision was made to cut overall European production, it was inevitable that some of that cut was going to fall in Ireland. And at the time, the Board of Irish Sugar made the decision to close Carlow and to move all the production to Mallow, which made sense if you're a producer. The problem was that an awful lot of the growers kind of that were north of Tipperary, and indeed including Tipperary, they began to look at the fact that the cost of transport of the sugar beet to Mallow would make it relatively uncompetitive or totally uncompetitive, depending on how far away they were. And I made the comment about the efforts to revise it, because in that proposal, it basically shared the cost of moving the beet amongst everybody, the people that were very near, the people that were very far away. And if that model had to be propagated within the industry before the decision was made to close it down, it might have actually been able to stay going. And now, I also remember that in 2006, which was the first year that we didn't have sugar beet, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there was a disastrous back end. And I'd say fellows were very glad they didn't have sugar beet to take out in December and January.
Yeah, Andy, obviously, I'm up here in Donegal, so we were never really in the sugar beet game. But just like, what, give us a sense of what was the mood on the ground from growers when this was all unfolding and when it happened. I mean, did they fully realize what was happening? There was compensation paid, wasn't there?
Yes, and Stephen, the compensation was in theory going to be paid to the countries who reduced their quota and closed down some of the production capacity. So the fact that the Carlow decision was made before the announcement came from Europe meant that the closure of Carlow didn't qualify for compensation. So now you had all the growers there who saw an industry moved 100 and something miles down the road, and they having great difficulty being able to afford to pay for the transport to get the sugar beet down there. And they said, well, the only way that we can access compensation is to actually get Mallow closed as well. So very quickly, there was a split came in the farming community. Those who wanted to shut down and opt for compensation, and those who wanted an industry to continue. And that became quite divisive for quite some time.
And then, so like, whose decision was it to close down Mallow? Was it kind of a collective decision amongst the farmers, or was it just Irish Sugar? Or
I suppose it was ultimately Irish Sugar, and there was politics outside of the comments I've already made that have a very big bearing on this. But yeah, I wouldn't have been as absolutely au fait with all of the politics to comment accordingly on them. But the decision ultimately came about because Ireland provided sugar to virtually every sugar user in Ireland. When the uncertainty began to arise over the future of the industry, the big exporters, producers and exporters on the continent began to zone in on the various sugar buyers, sugar users in Ireland. And the pressure came very quickly for Irish Sugar to make the decision on whether they were going to be able to supply or whether they should the customers should actually source the sugar elsewhere. And that in effect forced the decision, because Irish Sugar weren't in a position to guarantee supply. And I guess they took a view that the only sane decision that was there was to close it. Now, there will be lots of people in the industry, in the sugar industry, who will have been of a view that it was always on the cards, because there was very little investment in the sugar processing capacity of the country in the previous 10 to 15 years, because the industry had moved from public ownership to private ownership. And there would be those that would say that it was always destined for closure. And there were certain events that had happened that probably prompted some of the people on the political not the people you vote for, if I can say, that type of political person, who were probably happy, in a sense, to make the decision to close, while it might not have been what most farmers would have wanted if there was a willingness to negotiate a solution over the transport issue. And there may have been a willingness, but it never got to onto the discussion boards that I'm conscious of anyway.
Last question on sugar, Andy. Do you think, is it possible that we'll see the revival of the sugar beet industry or the sugar industry in Ireland at some stage?
I don't think so. I could be wrong in that. I don't think so. Not based on sugar beet. Not based on the fact that sugar is under pressure in so many different parts of the world. Plus the fact that it's kind of portrayed as the modern poison. Which of course it isn't, but it's portrayed as that in some instances because of obesity. But it may be a contributing factor, but it's not the sugar that's the cause, it's the overconsumption that's the problem. But it's difficult to see today how we would get back in there. Now, we do know that our overall beet yields and the genetics of beet yields have followed the genetics. Indeed, they've probably superseded the genetics of wheats and barleys and cereals, etc. So there's been very big inroads there, but I just don't see where or how it can happen. You know, a single factory, where would it be in a society where it may very well be unacceptable to import product from far away places? It's equally unattractive to kind of haul it 60, 80 miles, 100 miles on road to a single plant in the country when something is available at a much lower cost from other parts of the world. So, look, these are all new decisions. There are new analyses that would have to be done on the carbon benefits and the whole life cycle analysis in terms of where a benefit might come. As against that, I'm saying that maybe when it comes to milling wheat, we should be looking again at where we could use our wheat for the milling sector, which is a different statement to saying that we should produce all our milling wheat, because we can't produce wheat for many end uses. And we have to recognise that in terms of what our aspirations would be into the future.
Yeah, that's what I was going to go on to next, Andy. Like, you know, sugar beet, as you said, there was always income from sugar beet. And, you know, there's certain crops that we need in our systems that deliver a premium. And, you know, you're talking about, I know it's on next week's paper, malting milling in the drink sector. And you've mentioned milling there, like, you know, we don't have a viable milling industry at the minute. But like, those crops are so important for the tillage sector.
Yes, because they were the two crops that we're just talking about. Well, I include malting barley in there. They're the premium crops. They're the industrial crops. They're taking product away from the commodity feed markets. And, you know, if it's only worth a fiver, it's still a fiver that generally has little or no cost associated with it. Well, depending on what crop we're talking about. Like sugar beet in its day was the white gold. It was as profitable as milk, which was protected by a quota regime at the time. So it was a very, very profitable crop. Drove some bad decisions with regard to people's attitudes to Conacre and the price they could afford to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a very important crop. Milling wheat was important as an outlet, but it wasn't a big premium crop. You know, it was a crop that in certainly in my period in the industry, any premium for milling tended to be between 5 and 12 pounds a ton. Call that 7 to 15 euro a ton. Like 15 euro a ton turns into money, but the 7 euro a ton generally was only about able to carry the extra nitrogen that was needed to try and get the protein up into a level that was making it qualify. So it was less important, but it's a more strategic one, because in theory we could go without sugar. I know that's an impractical comment in terms of all the things that depend on sugar for their manufacture. But in theory, we could go without them, but it's much more difficult to go without staple foods like breads. And for as long as we're dependent on breads, then as of now, 99% of that is probably being imported from a combination of UK continent and North America.
And Andy, like, you talk about staples in the diet, and, you know, I suppose we're often saying it lately that, you know, Ireland isn't producing the staples of the diet, and our vegetable growers are leaving the sector. We're not even self-sufficient in potatoes anymore. What do you think it's going to take for the government and the policymakers to really drive on? Or do you think they want to drive it that we have, you know, a supply of Irish food in this country?
I think they may want it, but they're probably caught to some degree by the fact that we're subject to the laws of Europe. And if a European supplier wants to send stuff in here and it's competitive to do so, then it's difficult to stop them unless we have phytosanitary or other trading reasons that prevent that particular product from coming in here. That's much more active in the case of the livestock sector, where you have so many regulations regarding diseases across every type of livestock. You know, the controls were made much more relaxed or lax in the case of all crops in Europe when we joined the EEC, and they became more so as we became a union. So it's difficult to keep out the European, but there should be a lot more activity within Europe to keep out the non-European out of all of these equations, be it horticultural, vegetable, whatever. You know, we see ourselves the great difficulty that we've had trying to have any type of barrier put up against the potential importation of black grass, which I've often referred to as the TB of the tillage sector. It's moving internally, but it moved for a long time from the outside in before the internal movement has happened. And we've had much less willingness to operate those controls, probably because a bigger proportion of the overall population in officialdom were from an animal kingdom rather than from a plant kingdom, and they didn't necessarily see the real risks that were involved. But Siobhan, in attempting to answer your question, what will it take? You know, it's probably the same answer to that question that I could have used for the last 25 years. And that is that it will take a significant food scarcity in Europe to get people to realise the value of it. Because we can talk about circular economies in certain areas, but at the end of the day, when a customer goes to the supermarket shelf, we know where 80% of them are going to go. They're going to the bargain rails to pick up the cheapest thing. And that will remain an influence. But it's until either society is forced to be more sustainable in the decisions that it makes, and everybody in society is a consumer. And, you know, we as farmers and whoever from our household goes shopping on a weekly basis, they follow the same price trends that the consumer in the city in the city follows. You know, we should lead by example to begin with. We should always point out the examples of where the local supply chain is working. But I think it'll take that kind of a disaster, which would mean an escalated war relative to what we have today. And that would be a disastrous thing to even think of, Siobhan.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Anna, just to come back to that for a second, because on Spud's end, I have never seen a situation whereby potato farmers are in such a precarious position as what they are now in 2023. I know from first-hand experience that there's growers who are exiting the game this year, and the guys who are staying are kind of the attitude that they have, the others have to drop out in order for them to survive, that they're going to get to such a low kind of production level that it's going to drive up prices more or less. Like, but I don't know historically, has that been the case? Has a situation like that ever arose before?
In a scenario like we have in Europe, reducing production here is unfortunately not a recipe for to get prices up, because price is always dictated by imports, and the imports are coming from countries that generally have surplus, and they're trying to get rid of surplus. So they're generally discounting their export sale to get a premium for their internal supply. And we are the ones that suffer from that. And it's that messed up economic scenario that's kind of continuing to defeat farmers, not just Tillage farmers, but all farmers everywhere. You know, when somebody says that, you know, the cheapest whatever, let's say, you know, cheap grain from South America, the grain that's coming from South America is cheap, but it doesn't mean that the farmer that produced it is making money from it. Mm. He has produced product that doesn't have storage, or that doesn't have a market for him. And therefore, he has to move that to a place. He's been given as little as possible for it to supply it. You know, that's a problem. I was talking the other night to a farmer farming in the Ukraine, and he just told me now that it's costing them roughly 100 euro a ton equivalent to move their grain from store to market, which means from store to ship or railhead, one or the other. Like, that's a phenomenal cost. And it's against that type of background that I would always have seen big grain exporting countries inevitably moving into the livestock sector, so that they could walk off more value from their grain than having to carry that big cost of a relatively low value on a relatively low value product just to get it to market.
Yeah.
Like, and that sounds big, Stephen. Sorry, that sounds big, but like, we visited with the Tillage and Land Use Society, we visited South America in specifically Argentina, I'm talking about, in 2020. And I can remember at that stage, guys talking about movement costs at that stage of about $80 a ton, when the value of the grain that they were selling was also $80 a ton.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't let anyone tell me that being able to import cheap produce is good for the countries that are supplying it. In general, it's not. If they had a better economic model, they wouldn't be supplying cheap grain to the world market.
Yeah. And it just there, yeah, touched on the impact of the EC and now the European Union on Irish farming, but specifically for tillage farming, over the past 30, 40 years, what impact has it had on tillage farming? Has it been for the better, or has it been for the worst, to be perfectly blunt about it?
Combination of, Stephen. You know, unquestionably, the early EEC years were really, really good for farming, in that they brought prices up to European averages. They brought a market for the occasional times there were surpluses in the market. So, you know, there was the first decade of really buoyant response to what had been a dire enough living for people before that, across nearly all aspects of agriculture. But as we moved from, well, firstly, as we moved from deficit to surplus, we moved from economic policies that supported price and production to ones that began to contain or constrain or move responsibility away from production towards managing the surplus. That kind of caused an easing with regard to the driving on of investment then for a number of years. And then, of course, we got closer to having to cope with full surpluses. And then we had the great challenge of coping with the requirements of GATT, which subsequently became the WTO. And that, of course, brought the big changes when McSharry moved the support system in Europe away from price to an area-based payment. And then Franz Fischler moved it one step further away again, and basically decouples it completely from production in order to be able to comply with EU rules. So some of those things were good. Some of those things meant that people could begin to concentrate on the things that they were best at doing. But in other instances, you know, the response was negative. Policy was negative. We were forced to do things that we wouldn't want to do. And, you know, we spoke about some of them earlier in terms of how people viewed the tree crop rule, a fundamentally good policy. But we had come to a point where convenience had been the major driver. And arguably, we had ceased to be farmers and moved to be robots, because basically we did the same thing year after year after year in order to supposedly produce our income. So there was lots of things like that that automated agriculture within Europe that were fundamentally bad, because at the end of the day, it's the thinking farmer that'll survive, not the robotic farmer.
Okay, Andy, look, I think time is moving on, Siobhan, isn't it? But yeah. I know next week you're going to talk as well about the evolution of farm equipment, and I know there'll be a lot of interest in that one over your working career. Do you want to give us an insight into some of the big changes that you saw?
Well, Stephen, look, it'll be very small. I can only ever barely touch on any of these aspects and the changes that were there. But, you know, there's probably not that many people out there today actively growing crops who can remember that winter and spring crops were all sown behind either springtime or solid time cultivators, because that's how everything was done, with disc or coulter based drills as a separate run. Then in the 80s, we began to see the one pass systems coming in. It came in originally for winter crop production, but very quickly eased across into spring crop production. So, you know, that was an evolutionary change. We moved from there then to probably too much power harrowing in the system, and away from that to the cultivator drills that we have today. But in there, in the late 70s and into the 80s, we also had a big drive into mintail, a big drive into direct drilling as well. Both of which kind of failed over time. The ability to control grass weeds certainly beat the mintail operators of the day. But then the overall husbandry wasn't as good either. You know, we wouldn't have been using the stale seedbed nearly as well between two crops to try and keep that problem reduced or down to a minimum. And then, of course, we saw the modern, more better thought out mintail and direct drill systems that we have today. But interestingly, you know, they moved into rotation, whereas back in the 70s and 80s, people were moving out of rotation into continuous cereals. And there was no pressure relief valve in the system when that was happening. So they failed. And then, of course, in the latter years, we've had GPS come on stream and all of the uses that it's been put to. I think it was probably either in the late 90s or early 2000s when GPS came to the fore initially, through research that was going on, farm-based research that was going on in England and Britain on yield mapping of crops, with kind of the insinuation that if you know your yield is lower here, you should be doing something there, or at least you should begin to find out what you think the yield limitation is there and address that, which was 100% correct in its thinking. But the problem was, when you got another yield map next year, a different type of a year, the good bits and the bad bits were in different places. So people were left with a scenario where they didn't quite know how to use these things over time. So in the early years, as I would view it, it was a technology looking for a use. But relatively quickly that use came, in terms of the various versions of auto steer, the control systems for fertilizer spreaders, the control systems for sprayers, either down to a boom section level or even in an individual nozzle level. We saw the standard flat, initially in actual fact, the cone nozzle evolved to the fan nozzle, and the fan nozzle evolved to the low drift nozzle. Then we have the pulse nozzles that we have today. So no matter what element of mechanization you look at, there has been a massive evolution over that period. And that process of evolution is set to continue in my book.
Andy, something that all farmers are obsessed with is costs, and rightly so. And you go through some of the changes in costs in next week's pages as well. You might just tell us some of those, or give us the kind of picture of how things have changed.
Yeah, well, Siobhan, this actually was an ad that was in the Farmers Journal in I think 1974. And it was an ad for a complete engine overhaul on a Massey Ferguson 135. Which was to a fair degree the workhorse of the day. It was becoming the smaller end, but it was very definitely the workhorse of the day, small and all as it was. But that engine overhaul was priced at €280 to include pistons, rings, cylinder lighters, big end shells, an oil pump, valves and guides, gaskets and seals, and the same. Refurbishment on a 165 was €435, pounds converted, that is. To go back into just some other costs just out of the blue, a friend of mine gave me some of these recently. 1981, a ton of 18612 costing €177 a ton. A ton of Midas certified seed spring barley costing €285 a ton. A Leyland 272 tractor costing 11,300 for the tractor. And I know I also have one here for a shed, a 30-foot shed, 30-foot wide bay and four-bay shed, I think was coming in at €3,000.
Different
so,
times.
You know, change times, yeah. Everything has moved on.
Yeah, but as well as that, there was a proportion of obviously just inflation and where we're at now. But even in this decade and the last decade, everything has just kind of moved up over time.
Oh yes, it has. And you know, we went for a long time, probably over the last two decades, with very little inflation, but we're seeing quite a bit of inflation reappear now. But last year and for 2023 as well, we're going to see some fairly significant increases in the costs of things that we had taken for granted heretofore. So it's something that we're going to have to live with for the next number of years. And, you know, when inflation is happening, the farm input is going to be subject to the same inflation. Farm inputs, plural. There'll be very few that won't.
Yeah.
But then price moved as well, Siobhan, in answer to your question. You know, I gave those prices in the 70s of £50 to £60 a ton, which is ballpark €70-75 a ton. For that was green grain. Now, it's probably also worth remembering that in the 97, I would say that same price was probably in the 80s. So it's over quite a period of years. We had fluctuation in the meantime, but we've seen a number of years where we've seen really, really low prices. And the occasional year like 1983, 2007, where for various reasons and different reasons, we saw prices rise very, very substantially to give good returns. But I have to say, in all of that comment, that the first year that I've seen the Holy Trinity or the Holy Grail of crop production, good yields, good prices and good weather come together, where that the last pair of 2021 and 2022, never before that had I seen it, and I'm glad I lived to see it.
Yeah. Okay, Andy, look, I think we are coming towards the end of the podcast now. We're 55 minutes in, give or take. But look, I think to finish up, we have to ask you your views on where this is all going. And what I mean by that is the tillage sector, the Irish tillage sector, where do you see it going over the coming decades? What advances do you think are coming down the line that are going to make a difference? And I suppose, you know, are we as young farmers facing into the sector, like are we likely to see an increase in area or a decrease in area over the coming decades? Just what's your thoughts?
If you stand back from the history of grain production in Ireland, the area in grain crops, dairy crops, not just grain crops, has continued to decline since Adam was a boy. You know, there was a time when more than 50% of the agricultural land of Ireland was growing annual crops. That's now, in terms of land use, we're now probably just about 7%. Thereabouts, give or take a decimal point or two. Will that trend continue? Probably the overall trend will continue. It's ironic when I stand back from it that Ireland was always a 2 odd million ton producer of grain. So basically what we've seen is we've seen production maintain itself in the face of all of the changed land use. And the other thing that happened is that the natural inclination of the vast majority of Irish farmers was to hold wealth, to try and hold onto wealth from year to year. With a, with an annual crop, it was almost impossible to do that. And that's why so many people erred in favour of what the livestock would do to them and for them. So there was a natural gravitas towards livestock. For that reason alone, it wasn't always because of there was greater profitability or less work, that's for sure. But that was a fundamental reason. I think the problem that's there today for the livestock sector is the pressures that are going to come on the implications of overall livestock numbers for all of the climate change targets. And what's going to happen there, I don't know. But I guess to some degree, what will happen there will influence what will happen in the tillage sector. I also think that, you know, the historic farming method was based on mixed farm. We are not going to go back to mixed farms because it would be impossible to operate mixed farms with the level of regulation requirement that's there for any individual sector. People may very well be able to stay meeting the rules and regulations in a single enterprise. But if you moved two and three enterprises on the one farm, it would be almost impossible. And, you know, there's not a lot of joy in trying to live with the help of area aid, but to have that area aid equivalent based on whatever it's going to be in the future, now taken away from you because you've been penalised for this, that or the other, because you couldn't dot an I here or cross a T there. So, you know, that will be a pressure in the future. But if we begin to develop an industry that is going to be much more circular in its nature, if we see the movement of nutrients from tillage, which has always been unidirectional, they always came in a bag and they went out in all forms of organic matter. If we see that circle being kind of completed with organic nutrients coming back in to the tillage sector, then the importance of tillage and the placement of tillage as a way to cure the problems or some of the problems of the livestock sector may begin to force people to see tillage in a different way. It may also make it a bit more attractive, even though people wouldn't conceive of it today. It might make it a bit more attractive for people to consider having some tillage on their own ground, because I cannot foresee a situation where I look at 7.5 tons of raw carbon, not CO2, but carbon, leaving a tillage hectare every year and people being able to sustain that into the long term and see plateaued yields. Tillage farmers are going to have to try and do all they can to get soil carbon levels up, to get productivity up. And the price that's going to be there for straw could mean that for those who can afford to sell it, the people who are buying it might be less well able to afford it. And maybe the attractiveness of having their own may have to be put back on the table again, or at least considered again going forward. Does tillage have a future? Absolutely, yes. I can recall in the 90s, a particular individual was charged by the then Minister for Agriculture to come up with a plan for agriculture. And the plan stated that there would be 2,000 farmers growing cereals in, I think that was probably the turn of the century. I'm glad to report that that failed badly, because I can remember at the time setting it upon myself that if he will be right, then I would have failed. So I was very definitely running in a different direction to him at that time and what the comments of that report were. We will have tillage going forward, but we do need to do all we can to get back up onto that ladder of high yields. We need to have people looking at the things that we do, which will be a lot simpler than how we farm today, and they will cost a lot less money than what we're putting into grow acres and hectares today. And I think, you know, so much of that is totally dependent on soil health. I know people don't see it, but I would say that in time, research on soil health will give us potential solutions for problems that we're using bags and bottles to cure today. And that is ultimately the direction of travel that Europe is trying to push us in. And that's what makes me think that it will be the direction that will pertain into the future. But we do have a future, and I intend to serve it for a good while longer, in some way, form or fashion.
Good stuff. Andy, thanks a million for letting myself and Stephen grill you for the past hour. And I know listeners will really enjoy that. And indeed, they'll really enjoy reading the pieces in the paper over the next few weeks. And look, thanks for your contribution to the podcast over the last since its foundation. And I know everyone wishes you the best of luck in your retirement. But as you said, Andy, you know, you'll still be contributing to the tillage sector in a massive way. And no doubt you're not going to be a stranger to this podcast anyway. And we'll let you sign off for this week.
Well, Siobhan, how does one sign off after the job that you and Stephen have done for the past, I don't know how long we're doing this now, but it's so enjoyable to do it. And I know a lot of people enjoy listening to it. But suffice it to say that I'd just like to thank the very, very many, and I would say at this stage, hundreds of people who sent me messages of goodwill and good health in retirement. And the health certainly would be appreciated. And I've been so lucky. I think I was out of work 3 times in my career in the journal because of sicknesses. You know, I've been so lucky so far. And if it can continue to serve me well, I'll try to continue to contribute in a positive way for the betterment of everybody that's out there in the industry. So thank you for the privilege of allowing me to do the job I did, and for listening to us on the podcast as well. And with that, I wish everybody the holy trinity of grain growers once again: good weather, good yield and good prices for the year to come. I know they don't look likely at the moment, the prices that is, but who knows? Don't give up faith yet.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.